A man of such renown, and for many of us personally, such preciousness as Dr. Spock hardly needs any introduction. Dr. Spock's book on child care is recognized as having made a historic contribution toward relieving the anxieties of a whole generation of parents in bringing up their children. Having done so much to bring up an entire generation of physically and morally healthy young people, Dr. Spock has been unwilling to see their lives shattered or snuffed out in the jungles of Vietnam. Yet Dr. Spock is not a pacifist. He supported our entrance in World War II and in the Korean War. He recognizes that some wars may be necessary, bad as all may be, but he has the moral conscience and courage to also recognize that there may be wars which make no sense or have no justification or in no way contribute to the well-being and real interests of a people who may be led into them. Such has been his position on the war in Vietnam, which he has resolutely opposed on constitutional and legal grounds, believing it to be a violation of our own Constitution, as well as of the United Nations Charter and of the 1954 International Geneva Accords. A man of such colossal moral proportions as Dr. Spock is not easy for the common man to understand. Least of all does such a man ever fare well at the hands of the societal elite which judges him and punishes him. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great privilege to present a noble American conscience, a great American courage, Dr. Spock.
Thank you, Mr. Battesini. I've never been introduced in more glowing terms. I'm only afraid I don't quite deserve it. This whole matter of courage, let me quickly say, and I have a New England conscience and can't very well support a compliment that I don't feel easy about. I really got myself into trouble by signing the call to resist illegitimate authority, and then there were subsequent press conferences, and when we went down to the Department of Justice in Washington to shake them by the chin and tell them what were they, to reinforce the call. But my wife, before I signed the call to resist, said, like the realistic woman that she is, "Do you think there's the slightest chance the federal government will prosecute you for signing this?" Because there had been on the bottom of the one of the original forms of the call a statement, according to advice of counsel, signers might possibly subject themselves to prosecution with a punishment of 5 years in jail and $10,000 fine. I looked Jane right in the eye and I said, "There isn't the slightest chance in the world. They wouldn't be so foolish." I wouldn't be so foolish. Obviously, my judgment about the Johnson administration was way off. On the other hand, I do think, still think, that they were foolish. I've never had such audiences. You know, I've been in the peace movement since 1962, talking to small, dispirited, middle-aged audiences of people who'd been in the peace movement for years, and then audiences never got any bigger or any more vehement. And but since I've been indicted, I have huge audiences of enthusiastic young people. I never had it so good. And I try to ignore the possible thought that I might end up in jail.
Thank
Now, what I would like to do, I know that you're all not in favor of my position, and let me say to those who opposed me in one way or one degree to another, the kind of things I say, do not assume that you all agree. I will give you a chance to not only question me, but to attack me if you want to later when we come to the question and answer period, which we'll get to as fast as we can. Meanwhile, I will speak as frankly and as one-sidedly as I'm able to, because I don't... I won't go into details about the war in Vietnam and so on, because I'm sure that, especially at Michigan State, you've been all over this stuff again and again and again. You're a hotbed for both positions, as you undoubtedly know. So let me tick them off in an arbitrary way, and if I'm too arbitrary, then get at me in the question and answer period. I'm against the war in Vietnam because, in the first place, the United States had not only no business, it had no invitation to go in there, did not go in response to aggression. It went in purely, from my point of view, as an imperialist gesture, a land grab. And, Eisenhower, the year before the French fell, explaining to the 48 governors, said, you know, the reason we've been paying for 8 years, 80% of the bill of the French, who were trying to reimpose colonial world and were rule and were finally overthrown, he said, isn't that we love the French so much. He says, we're interested in the tin and tungsten and other valuable materials in this part of the world, and we want to have some control over it. And there is not the slightest evidence that anybody invited us. And furthermore, the CETO agreement that's sometimes quoted by Lyndon Johnson as part of our excuse, all that was an agreement to consult with each other, and the call never went out for this consultation. So that's absolute hokum about the CETO agreement. You remember the United States, after the French defeat, did not sign the Geneva Accords itself, but it signed a separate snotty agreement in which it said it would refrain, it promised to refrain from interfering with the carrying out of the Geneva Accords. And they said, for one thing, there's to be no foreign troops here, no foreign country is to interfere, the country is to be divided temporarily into two zones, but it's not to be a political division, and within 2 years there must be an election. In which the Vietnamese people, reunited, will choose whatever the government they want. And Eisenhower, again, he's so ingenuous. He helped the peace movement in those days with the kind of statements he made. In his memoirs, he said, everybody that he consulted who was an expert agreed that if we'd allowed the election to go ahead, that had been promised by the Geneva Accords to the Vietnamese people, and which accords the United States promised not to interfere with, if we'd allowed them to go ahead, the Vietnamese people would have voted 80% for Ho Chi Minh. In other words, there was no doubt in our government's mind that it was making a grab, and that it was making a grab which would be opposed by 80% of the people. And basically, this is why we've never been able to get to first base. We've been able to destroy the country, and we've been able to kill 1 million people and kill 30,000 Americans, but we haven't ever been able to get anywhere because the people are probably more than 80% opposed to us now. The only people on our side are the so-called Mandarin class, the absentee landowners who live in the big cities, the army officials, the officials of the country, and now the profiteers. These are the only people on our side. They were the same people who were on the side of the French during the 8 years when the Vietnamese were trying to throw out the French. From the Vietnamese point of view, traitors to their country. That's the first illegality. The United States the United States brought Diem, our first puppet, from the United States. We found him here. And we brought him and transported him to Vietnam and set him up. And we might have gotten away with it if he wasn't so tactless and tyrannical and suspicious. Filled the jails to overflowing, not only canceled the election promised to the people as a whole, but he canceled the village elections that had always been a feature of Vietnamese life. And then the most tactless thing of all was he took the land that Ho Chi Minh had distributed among the peasants. When Ho Chi Minh controlled three quarters of the country, He took it back from the peasants and gave it back to the land absentee landlords. No way to get yourself popular in a poor, predominantly peasant agricultural country. The second illegality was, of course, when the Viet Cong revolt broke out under Kennedy's regime. According to the promises U.S. gave the U.N., we should have submitted the threat to the peace to the U.N., didn't do so. Characteristic of the United States, refers to the U.N. only those issues in which it's pretty sure that it'll be able to embarrass communist countries, and carefully keeps and has the power to keep from referring those issues in which it might think it would be embarrassed or its aims would be interfered with. Then the third illegality, and the worst one of all, was Lyndon Johnson escalating the war, breaking his promise to obey the Constitution that says only Congress can declare war, especially reprehensible in a president who only 2 months before he escalated was elected president on the promise that he would not escalate and they didn't believe in sending Americans to fight in an Asian country. As you probably know, I might as well admit I actually helped in a small way to elect Lyndon Johnson in 1964 and got thanked by him by a personal call over the telephone within 2 days. So I had a personal reason to feel outraged and betrayed when 2 months after promising not to escalate, he escalated anyway. Lyndon Johnson, of course, has always said that the Tonkin Gulf resolution of the previous summer of 64, was the equivalent of a declaration of war. But of course, he sold that resolution to Congress by what I would call fraud, F-R-A-U-D. He said there was unprovoked attack on our naval forces by the naval forces of North Vietnam, and he asked Congress to authorize him to repel such aggression. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee finally found out enough of the truth to make the following generalizations. The United States Navy had equipped and trained a Saigon naval force which was making an attack on a North Vietnamese naval installation with the knowledge and cooperation of our Navy. And as a matter of fact, our Navy was participating to the point of sailing past that harbor and sailing off in a northeast direction, hoping to draw the North Vietnamese naval forces so that our Saigon puppet naval force could be less interfered with it when it made the attack. Our government, unable to win the war because basically the people are against us, thereupon took to wholesale violation of the laws of war, which are codified in the Hague Convention and the Geneva Convention, to which the United States has affixed its signature. We have been deliberately poisoning and destroying crops, forbidden by international law. We have been burning and otherwise destroying dwellings, deliberately. This is forbidden by international law. We then take the people from these search and destroy missions and we put them in what amount to concentration camps, and they are there to the numbers of hundreds of thousands, absolutely forbidden by international law. And we have been deliberately bombing cities. Felix Green in his movie shows village after village, city after city in North Vietnam that has no conceivable strategic value, absolutely reduced to rubble by our bombers. And some of those cities with no strategic targets have been bombed 15 or 20 times. And we've killed, we've used anti-personnel bombs in North Vietnam. Despite our Defense Department's promise that we're only bombing strategic targets, meaning bridges, military installations. Anti-personnel bombs are designed to tear human flesh off human bones, clearly only used to kill people and to terrorize people, and we've been using that wholesale over North Vietnam. I want to make the point, this war is not slightly illegal or moderately illegal. It's totally illegal. It's totally immoral. Furthermore, I believe that it's been detrimental to the best interests of the United States in every way. We have lost our leadership of the free world. I know that we are despised by millions of people around the world who used to think we were a decent country and now compare us with Hitler, with Hitler's gang. And we've killed 30,000 American and wounded 200,000 Americans, and we've never gotten anywhere. We've been actually pushed back step by step. In the Tet Offensive of a year ago, our opponents were overrunning the capital city, which was also our headquarters. Now I want to add just one other important thing before I go on to the relationship of this and the right to dissent, which it isn't directly involved in dissent. I think that our participation in Vietnam is not an accident. It's not an aberration of U.S. foreign policy. The United States has always thrown its weight around to the degree that it was able to throw its weight around. And the trouble is that we ended up World War II incomparably the strongest country in the world with power vacua all around the place, and we couldn't resist the temptation. We have military bases to the number, Felix Green says, of over 3,000 in 30 foreign countries. Our industries, through their ingenuity, have penetrated the markets around the world and have set up branches in such places as Canada, England, France, to such a degree that there's agitated discussion from time to time in the parliaments of those countries. They fear that if there were a recession in the United States, that the U.S. industry would favor the local branches and close the foreign branches, throwing perhaps those countries into deeper depression than ourselves. Through aid, military aid and non-military aid, we directly control to a degree the foreign policy of many countries. We have insisted that the countries that get our aid have no commerce with China. We force them to give up trade with China. We've done the same thing about Cuba. And the Labour government of England and Madame Gandhi's government in India are unable to criticize openly United States policy in Vietnam because the United States could precipitate them into serious financial difficulty by cutting off aid. So that's a it's a direct control, which of course is severely resented. Then we have our CIA, which within a few years of the war overthrew a popular government in Iran, the Mossadegh government, tried to overthrow a popular government in Indonesia. In Guatemala, under the Eisenhower administration, overthrew a popularly elected government, the Arbenz government in Guatemala. The Arbenz government, Arbenz had promised to divide up the landed estates and distribute them to the poverty-stricken peasants of Guatemala. And the trouble was that the largest landowner in Guatemala is the United Fruit Company. And the United Fruit Company appealed to Eisenhower. And Eisenhower sicked the CIA on them, which carried out a revolt, and the Eisenhower administration boasted of that. They thought that was good American foreign policy to overthrow a popularly elected person at the behest of an American industry and then to reinstall a military dictatorship, which they've had since in Guatemala. We tried the same thing in Cuba. We interfered outrageously in the Dominican Republic in that same fateful spring of 1965. Lyndon Johnson landed 20,000 troops when a hated, cruel, oppressive dictatorship had been overthrown on the say-so of a panicky American ambassador who said communists might take over. When they counted the communists, it turned out there were 12 in the Dominican Republic, six of whom had been in prison all the time. Now, in saying these things, I don't mean that the United States is worse than any other country. I don't think the United States is worse. The United States has some real advantages. It's my country. I have no readiness to turn to any other country. I like many things about America and Americans. But I'm convinced that any country that has such power, military, financial, political, will use it sooner or later to try to expand its power. This is the same as individuals. I'm not cynical about human nature or about human societies. I think that one has to be realistic and recognize that this is true. Labour government in England, the first one, turned out to be just as imperialistic as any conservative government. Soviet Union has moved into Baltic and the Balkan countries just as ruthlessly, and then later on in Hungary and now Czechoslovakia for the second time. It's somewhat irrespective of philosophy of government. This is the itch of human beings, individually or collectively, to move in when they see the opportunity and then give a marvelous sounding explanation afterwards of what they did. British Empire, when it covered the whole map of the world with red splashes, said it was carrying out the white man's burden, suffering to bring civilization to the other regions of the world. And you know what Americans say, American governments say, and many American publications say, we're saving those countries from communism. I'm for standing up for aggression. I was for the United States standing with South Korea. I would be still for the United States if it decides in its wisdom to make a military alliance with India, for instance, a government that's supported by its people and they are subject to a clear-cut aggression. I think that is aggression, and I think if the United States has agreed to come to their aid, it should come to their aid, though those agreements should be not entered into foolishly. What I object to is those cases where it's clearly the United States which is the aggressor, then trying to claim that it's protecting a country from communist takeover. And this, you'd think that Lyndon Johnson and Rusk and the rest would be ashamed of themselves the number of times they kept saying we were helping to repel aggression there. Nobody else in the rest of the world believes that. Only they and the American people who don't bother to go and look up anything in the library or to read anything but their own paper. Those are the only people who agree, who were fooled, and take this as gospel truth. I'm saying these things not because I think that we should be more considerate of other people, though I think in the long run to save our country we should. I say them because I think that a country like the United States, expanding and expanding, becoming more and more arrogant in its expansion, will eventually go crazy and bring down destruction upon itself. And I use examples like the fact that all the time Lyndon Johnson was escalating, destroying more and more of Vietnam, taking in more and more targets, there were hotheads in large numbers in Congress, editors of editorial writers in newspapers and others saying, let's bomb Hanoi, in spite of the fact that China said this would be the excuse for China coming into the war. I always wondered if we can't beat an enemy a quarter our size, which has been the truth, what are we going to do when 10 million Chinese come into the war? And those same people were shouting, bomb Haiphong Harbor, in spite of the fact that the Soviet Union has said, you bomb our ships in Haiphong Harbor and we'll come into the war directly. This is the kind of craziness that gets to a country and its citizens and its officials when they're too big for their britches and they get so they can't stand any opposition at all. And these Americans couldn't stand the fact that we didn't win, that the Vietnamese didn't lie down and play dead and let us rule their country, and so they wanted to go ahead and provoke China and the Soviet Union into the war. This is the kind of madness that has afflicted not only us, this has afflicted, I'm sure, other great empires in the past. All you have to do is remember back in history to some of the great empires of the past and realize every one of them, while they existed, I'm sure felt that they were impregnable, that they could never fall. Every one of them has fallen and disappeared, and the United States will eliminate itself someday, either by drawing down nuclear attack, nuclear war in which the whole northern hemisphere destroys it. The whole northern half of the world will destroy itself, or it will gradually win the hatred of every people around the world and somehow or other be penalized into a position, just the way Hitler, in spite of his great successes for a while eventually drew the hatred and the determination of the whole world to destroy him. It's paranoia. This is what it is. It's paranoia, as in an individual so in a country, when it goes out hostily, aggressively, to impose its might, and then keeps saying that we're the good guys and it's the others who are the bad guys. We're destroying Vietnam because it won't let us impose our puppets, and we say that we're saving it from communism. Now, let me switch now. What does this have to do, as an example, with the right to dissent? I'm often reproached by people who disagree with me, and it happened in the press conference at 2:30 this afternoon. So you think that you're allowed to pick and choose which laws you will obey and which laws you won't obey. I never claimed the right to pick and choose. In fact, I've been a very good person all my life. I think, if anything, I erred on the side of being a little too timid, certainly back in childhood. And in the present, in the present situation, I'm not picking and choosing. I say that my country has been on the edge of destroying itself, and that in a democracy, if you believe your country is destroying itself, you're obligated to say something about it. You're obligated to try to persuade other people. And I also say that what we did when we signed the call to resist illegitimate authority, this was not begging people to resist induction. We were accused of conspiracy to counsel, aid, and abet draft resistance. But even the jury said we never tried to counsel anybody. There was no evidence of this. Aiding and abetting said just what we said, that we, in the call, we said the war is totally illegal. We will express our moral backing for the young men who are risking prison and are already in prison. To conscientiously oppose this war. And we will offer them financial support to the degree that we can do so. And we said in the call, this is according to the Nuremberg Principle. The Nuremberg Principle was that by which the United States and its allies put to death many German war criminals, so-called, and Japanese war criminals. When those war criminals were being tried for crimes against humanity, they said we were only obeying orders of our government or our superiors. And our judges said, that's no excuse. If you knew that the course that you were asked to obey orders on was an illegal and immoral one by international law, you were obligated to refuse to obey those orders. And we put them to death. And if the United States can put to death Germans and Japanese for obeying orders, then surely in my reasoning this applies to Americans too. And this, all of it, the threat to the danger of the United States itself, as well as the horrible destruction of Vietnam, and the fact that we had the Nuremberg Principle, all of this seemed to me a much more important law to be obeying than the regulations of General Hershey about who can say this and who can say that. Now, I think for those who are interested in the whole matter of dissent, they ought to make a great point, if they haven't done it already, of reading the article by Professor Joseph Sachs, professor of law at the University of Michigan, which was in the Saturday Review of Literature, I think it was September 28, 1968, last fall, in which a professor of law tells people who aren't lawyers, gives them a better perspective on what is the law and what isn't. He says lay people, and it certainly was true about me, have the idea that there is a total of laws, municipal, state, federal, all more or less integrated, all in agreement with each other, so that every citizen at any moment can tell whether the action he is carrying out is legal within that circle or whether it's illegal without the circle. He says no such thing. There's tens of thousands of laws, many of them in conflict with each other. And it takes the courts to decide with a certain act, whether this was legal or whether it wasn't legal. And a case has to go through all the way through to the Supreme Court often to decide which was it legal or wasn't it legal. He makes the point that even after it gets to the Supreme Court, it's not easy for those great jurists to decide, because many of their decisions are 5-4 or 6-3. And he makes the further point, which seems to me particularly relevant. The Supreme Court decided long ago that separate education for black children was equal. And then it decides in 1954, no, how could we have said, or how could that other Supreme Court have said that it was equal and fair? Now we agree that it wasn't fair. In other words, it takes a long time and lots of judicial work to decide what's right and what isn't, especially between two conflicting laws. Take the case of Rosa Parks, a very dignified black woman that I met at Dr. King's funeral, holds an important place in the history of civil rights. She'd been working all day for white folks and was tired. She got on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. There was a seat up front. The laws of Montgomery said she can't sit in that seat. She's got to go to the rear and stand up. And Rosa Parks couldn't believe that that was the law, though she'd heard it all her life and had been obeying the regulations. So she sat down. And it went through the courts and finally got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, Rosa Parks, you're right. This is the law of the land. And I expect someday that the Supreme Court, present Supreme Court or some later Supreme Court, when I'm alive or when I'm dead, to say, by the way, Ben Spock was right, and more importantly, I think it's also important, while we're talking about law and order and the right to dissent, to realize, first of all people like law and order, provided it's based on justice. But that if people feel that they're subject to great injustice, they will first try legal means, and if those don't work, they're going to get more and more angry, and they're going to use illegal means. And when you begin to tick off the significant turns of history in our country or around the world, it's surprising to find how few things were decided by law and order and how many things were decided by more vehement means, to use a mild expression. How did women get suffrage in the United States? Not by writing letters to their senators and representatives. Eventually, they smashed windows, they knocked over statues, they lay down in the middle of the street, and they made nuisances of themselves until Congress finally surrendered and gave them the suffrage. How did labor get unionized? It wasn't by waiting around during the 1930s. Labor was desperate because industry had the overwhelming control over unionization, was preventing unionization and preventing union strength. And they came to blows, and heads were bashed, and people were actually killed. And industry behaved ruthlessly, and the unions in response behaved ruthlessly. And they had sit-down strikes that had no legality at all. And it was after labor showed that it was not going to take this injustice any longer, then it was that Congress passed the Wagner Act, which since has given labor certain rights on the national scene. Let's remember how the United States became a country. There's a Declaration of Independence, and it says, a people, when they feel that they are being treated unjustly, first try legal means. And if that doesn't work, it doesn't say they're allowed to break into somebody's office and smoke his cigars. This Declaration of Independence says they're entitled to make a revolution. That's strong talk. I understand things are a little tense around here. I don't want anybody to say that that I am advocating, directly or indirectly, revolution or violence. I'm only making the point. Let's take the case of justice to black people, that the injustice that black people have taken for 350 years, abuse, terrible discrimination, daily humiliation. Now, this is the lot of black people and has been for 350 years. Think of how much worse this is than anything that the colonists suffered in the last part of the 18th century. How in the world can our governors and mayors and editorial writers lecture black people about law and order must be reinstituted when all that happened was a small amount of rioting by a few desperate people at the very bottom of the heap? The extraordinary thing is that the overwhelming majority of black people go on patiently, and now gradually less and less patiently, taking this abuse. White people would have never taken this, I can tell you that. It would have been revolution long ago if there'd been a black majority trying to treat us the way we've treated the blacks.